You are listening to the Brighton Book Club on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, a monthly show about books and writing in Brighton and beyond. On this episode, we take a deep dive into the Man Booker long list with KD Books, aka Booker Boy, talk to founder of the online charity bookshop, The Brighton Bookshop, and talk to the author of this month's book club book, Evie Wilde, about her mesmerising novel, The Bass Rock.
I am really excited to be joined by you, Kieran / KD Books, to talk about the Man Booker long list, because you are the only person who I know and would call a friend, if not an internet friend, that has read the whole list. And I am desperate to find out what you thought of everything. So if you are happy, what I would like us to do is to go through the long list of books that didn't make it. I want to hear Herb, and then I want to hear your lowdown on it. Then we're going to go through the shortlist, and then I would love to hear what your top three are and who you think will win and if it's the same as who you want to win.
Ooh, okay. Again, I'm ready for this.
Rachel Cusk, second place. Tell me everything.
A woman invites a famed artist to a remote coastal landscape where she lives. Powerfully drawn to his painting, she believes his vision may penetrate the mystery at the center of her life. But as long dry summer sets in, his provocative presence soon twists the human patterns of her secluded household.
Ooh.
That's very Rachel Cusk. What did you think of it?
This was my first ever Cusk, so I actually have nothing to relate it to. But wonderful prose, beautifully written. Some people might be frustrated by the repetition, especially of the name Jeffers in it, which is now has a little bit of cult acclaim. But I think this is one of the works where you would need to know what she's drawing from, which is from a 1930s memoir from Luhan, of which I haven't read. But apparently this book takes verbatim from that as well. And so I think some of it went over my head. I wasn't sure what she was drawing from, but all in all, if you're just interested in good writing on a page, I don't think I would hesitate to recommend Cusk, and I'd be interested to read more of her works.
Okay, great. That seemed like a very measured response. So let's go on to Nathan Harris, The Sweetness of Water. I love this title, first off.
So, in the dire days of the American Civil War, newly freed brothers Landry and Prentice find themselves cast into the world without a penny to their names. Forced to hide out in the woods near their former Georgia plantation, they are soon discovered by the landowner, George Walker, a man still reeling from the loss of his son in the war. Now, Anna, do you like Of Mice and Men?
I do, in that I have never forgotten it since my GCSE.
Do you like Brokeback Mountain?
I love Brokeback Mountain.
Would you like a book set in American Civil War, which is very similar to Of Mice and Men, at about three pages of Brokeback Mountain?
I think I would.
That's The Sweetness of Water for you. No, I really didn't like this one.
You didn't like
all.
This one?
Really, okay. Didn't like it. It's, for what I thought it was going to do and what it did do was very different. But I think had he not told me it was American Civil War, I wouldn't have known, apart from like some very obvious, like wink, wink, nudge, nudge, let me mention this. I probably wouldn't have known.
So can I assume then that you are not a fan of Mice and Men and Brokeback Mountain?
I really like those two, but I don't want to read a 400 page book. I'd rather just watch the 1 hour film of the 180 page book, to be honest. So...
enough. I'm kind of intrigued to read it now to see if I agree. So we're moving on now to Kazu Ishiguro, who is a frequently makes this list with his new book, Clara and the Sun. I've heard a lot about this one and I'm desperate to know what you think.
From her place in the store, Clara, an artificial friend with outstanding observational qualities, watches carefully the behaviour of those who come in to browse, and of those who pass the street outside. She remains hopeful a customer will soon choose her, but when the possibility emerges that her circumstances may change forever, Clara is warned not to invest too much in the promises of humans. Have you read Ishiguro before?
I have read, what's the one that everyone's read?
Remains of the Day or Never Let Me Go.
Never Let Me Go, yeah.
Okay, this is like Never Let Me Go light.
Okay.
But is very much in the vein that all Ishiguro novels, to me, are very consistent, be that in how he writes, how he unfolds the story. And I have always said that if you've read one Ishiguro, you've kind of read them all. And I don't think there's any difference with Clara and the Sun. It's not as heavy on the sci-fi aspect as Never Let Me Go. But I've had some really good conversations about this. I thought it was okay. I don't think it's his best work. But most of the conversations I've had about Clara and the Sun have been intriguing, especially from a religious angle. But I'd recommend people pick this one up. I think this is good. Good bang for your buck.
Okay, excellent. And, you know, a book that starts conversations is a book that starts conversations, you know?
Yeah, they're really good. Yeah, he's consistent. If you like Ishiguro, it's a no-brainer.
Do you think, though, that it's a kind of strength or limitation if you have such a clear recipe for your books?
I've always said it's a bit of a double-edged sword. And in my review, I've said it's a double-edged sword because if you don't like him, you're going to not like the book.
Yeah.
And if you do like him, you're going to come out absolutely loving the book.
Yeah,
it's a hard one. It's a hard one. I think I would say choose it because it might be the one that kind of goes, oh, okay, that's what I like about Ishiguro.
Mm-hmm.
I've kind of havered between not particularly enjoying his books, but they have always stayed with me for some reason.
Okay, all right. So Karen Jennings, An Island.
The one that no one could get their hands on. When it was announced, the booker, I think there were only 19 reviews on Goodreads.
Wow.
It's like,
who publishes it, Karen?
The person who publishes is Holland House.
Okay.
Which I have never heard of, and I looked at their catalogue. And some interesting stuff, actually.
Yeah.
Some interesting stuff.
An independent publisher?
Independent publisher. They only made 500 copies of the book. And I think I'm correct in saying this, when it was announced for the booker, Karen Jennings still hadn't got a copy of it because she's in Brazil. So I had a copy before Karen Jennings. Yes.
Well, congratulations. But what is it about?
Samuel has lived alone for a long time, with only the occasional visits from a boat to bring in supplies, and in the past, a government representative from the mainland. He maintains the lighthouse and his chickens and watches the waves. Then one morning, he finds the sea has brought someone to offer companionship and threaten his solitude.
Ooh, that sounds quite appealing to me. What did you think about it?
Going into it, I had Castaway with Tom Hanks. I also had Lost, the TV program that everyone hated towards the end. It's not really that type of book, though. It's very much about colonization, the rise of the dictator, and contemporary African politics. But with an island, there's a debate going on. Is it Madagascar or is this somewhere fictional? And is the mainland somewhere like South Africa? Because Jennings is South African herself, it would make sense with apartheid and everything that has gone on in that part of the country. Or is she taking Africa as literally the entire country?
Mm.
That like schoolboy era. I think it talks about a lot of things. I don't think it executes them well, but Jennings's prose is, I found, expertly clunky.
Expertly clunky. What do you mean by expertly clunky?
It seems very methodical. It seems very purposeful, but I can't keep up sometimes after three sentences where we are, who's talking, and what part of Africa we're in. So she'll swap tenses. She'll swap as if like daydreaming.
Right.
So the character might do something to another character, but that actually hasn't happened, but she's only going to tell you that the next paragraph down the line.
Right. Okay, cool. So not an easy read by any means.
No.
Okay, so how about Mary Lawson's A Town Called Solace? Another title that I really liked. What is this one about?
This one I'm going to start off with saying it's great. Clara's sister is missing. Angry, rebellious Rose had a row with their parents, stormed out of the house and simply disappeared. 7-year-old Clara, isolated by her distraught parents' efforts to protect her from the truth, is grief-stricken and bewildered. Liam Kane, newly divorced, newly unemployed, newly arrived in this small northern town, moves into the house next door, a house left to him by an old woman he can barely remember, and within hours gets a visit from the police. He seems a suspect of crime. At the end of her life, Elizabeth Orchard is thinking about a crime too, one committed 30 years ago that had tragic consequences for two families, and in particular for one small child. She desperately wants to make amends before she dies.
Lots going on there. That sounds like my kind of book. You're smiling.
This, I would say, if someone said, what's an Anna book? I would be throwing this in Royal Mail and sending it to you.
This
is great. This isn't, look, is this a book that's going to change the world? No. Bro, you've got to absolutely enjoy yourself 100%. I grinned all the way through this. It's just great. It's a good, pacey page turner that it's not, it's just doing everything well. It's not trying to show off. It does the classic, and it does the classic al dente.
Oh, and it's just how I like my pasta.
Yeah.
Right. That, and honestly, sounds really, really up my street.
If you like Anne Tyler or like a really good plotted thriller, this is like the book for you. But even if you don't like those, because I'm not particularly a thriller reader or an Anne Tyler reader, you just gonna have a great time. I loved this. It was great.
I like Anne Tyler and I like a thriller, so excellent. Right, let's move on to China Room by Sanjeev Sahota.
Meha, a young bride in rural Punjab, is trying to discover the identity of her new husband. It is 1929 and she and her three sister-in-laws are married to three brothers in a single ceremony. Spend their days hard at work on the family farm, sequestered from contact with men. When Meha develops a theory as to which of them is hers, a passion is ignited that will put more than one life at risk. Spiraling around Meha's story is that of a young man who, in 1999, travels from England to the sun-scorched farm, by now deserted for decades. In enforced flight from the traumas of his adolescence, his experiences of addictions, racism and estrangement from the culture of his birth, he spends a summer in painful contemplation and recovery, finally gathering the strength to return home.
And what did you think?
I really like this. This is a very, what I call like a quiet book. Not much happens. And it's a lot about observation, especially from Meha, who's the 15-year-old, who's trying to figure out who she's marrying. Which differs very greatly from then, who is her great-grandson, who is the man living in 1999, who's a recovering drug addict. This isn't an interconnected story that I thought it might have been. It is literally just about two different people who are only tied by blood, but have not met each other. Mm-hmm. So it's a tricky one. I liked this one, but tried to talk about it and kind of say what it is really difficult, I have found. But I'll try to think of like what it would even be close. Maybe similar to like Kazuro Ishiguro, that like quiet, very slow pace, slow burn, good payoff. That's what I would say for this one. So maybe if you're considering Clara and the Sun, I would go for this one. It hasn't stayed with me as much as I thought it would have.
Okay. Interesting. Right. So the last book on the long list that didn't make the short list is Frances Spufford's Light Perpetual. What's this one about? Oh, you're shaking your head. I don't know if this is good or bad.
Oh. November 1944. A German rocket strikes London and five young lives are atomized in an instant. November 1944. That rocket never lands. A single second in time is altered and five young lives go on to experience all the unimaginable changes of the 20th century. Maybe because they are always other futures, other chances.
Oh, okay. Time slips often make me uncomfortable because I can't keep up with them. Was this the case for you or was it not?
I bummin' loved this. I bloomin' loved it. This is exactly what it says on the tin. There are five children who were bombed in 1944 during a Woolworths when a new delivery of saucepans arrived. And then Spufford has reimagined everything about their lives. They're not based on real people, although children did die in the incident. It's not set in a real London borough. He's made up his own and then goes, here's some children who haven't really experienced anything bar the war, haven't really had any life experiences. Let's see what happens. And you're just there for the ride with it. I loved this.
What an interesting concept.
What I liked about this is the Spufford doesn't shy back on the dark periods of Britain. He's not there going, it's a little bit of a nostalgia trip. But yeah, like one of the characters does end up embroiled in neo-Nazism. Ooh. That you're not expecting. There is a lot of racism that occurs. And Spufford's there going, well, it did happen. And these characters at some point probably would have been participating in it. And do they learn from it or do they don't? There's a Samaritan call within this as well, which he says it probably doesn't actually go this way. But yeah, I really liked this. I think it's clever, but some people cannot get past the fact that what's the point of the bomb if he's just going to make everything up anyway?
Well, that's storytelling, isn't it?
Well, this is the thing. Because obviously the kids die when they're really young. And have, because it happens in a second, they never have to understand what happened or how to die. Mm. Towards the end of the novel, as they're old, they have to face, well, what happens when I do die? They kind of, their morality comes up to them, which they don't, which juxtaposes when they're kids. I love this. I really wanted it to win.
Oh, that's a bit of a spoiler. Right, so books made the shortlist.
Still not over it.
By Anouk Arunprogasam. Excellent. What is A Passage North about?
It begins with a message, a telephone call informing Christian that his grandmother's former caregiver, Rani, has died in unexpected circumstances at the bottom of a well in her village in the north of Sri Lanka. Her neck is broken by the fall. The news arrives on the heels of an email from Anjum, an activist he fell in love with 4 years earlier while living in Delhi, bringing with it the stirring of distant memories and desires.
Intriguing. I'm intrigued. What did you think?
Oh, this book is pretty much a 10-minute walk, an 8-hour train journey and a 10-minute walk. And it's just Krisham, who's the main character, completely in his head, thinking about everything. Arunprogasam has a degree in philosophy, and it shows. This is just a philosophical pondering on a train. There's no dialogue. He doesn't speak to anyone. It's just him inside his own head. You're either going to get on board with this or you're not. And I did not get on board with it. I did not alight at the station.
I can imagine this is the kind of train that I would maybe miss on purpose.
If you like a book about a man called Krisham, whose grandmother's care has died, and you just want to know about that, this is your book. That's it.
Okay, let's stop here before we get in any trouble. So let's let's move on to The Promise by Damon
Galgut.
Oh yeah, sorry, I can't.
That's fine.
Well, the font's really small on my computer.
What a horrid cover. I know we gotta cut this out,
but that is very creepy. I urge you, if you're listening, to look up The Promise by Damon Galgut, G-A-L-G-U-T, to see it.
The American cover has the British one down. I'm just saying that. But The Promise charts the crash and burn of a white South African family living on a farm outside Pretoria. The Swarts are gathering for Ma's funeral. The younger generation, Anton and Amor, detest everything the family stand for, not least the failed promise to the black woman who has worked for them her whole life. After years of service, Salome was promised her own house, her own land, yet somehow as each decade passes, that promise remains unfulfilled.
Okay, what are your thoughts?
Do you like Four Weddings and a Funeral?
More than most things, yes.
Imagine four funerals, but no wedding.
No, I don't want that.
So this takes part of over four funerals. with each character in some way, shape, and form dying. And then the Swartz family are basically dragged back to meet each other, have awkward conversations with their families because someone's died. Okay. And kind of everything kind of resurfaces from that point of view. Mm-hmm. I think this is really interesting if you like J.M. Kutsaya's work. This is along the same veins, I would say, as Disgrace, but I prefer J.M. Kutsaya. This one's okay. I don't hate it. I don't love it. I think the end is like gut punching. Like what you think's going to happen, and then just the bluntness of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a really like effective and like efficient way of closing this book off.
Okay, so that really stayed with you.
That stayed with me. And I'd say his style. So for anyone, if you've not read this, Galgut's a little bit of a trickster. So he will come into the book and say, but you do know when you die, people will laugh at you, like direct to the reader. Or like you think that people don't know this, but like they'll know and they will tell all your family. But equally, he will come in saying, I know that the logistics of this instance happening is very slim, but just ignore it. Let's just say it did.
So he's breaking the fourth wall with the reader.
A lot.
Okay. And that's, again, quite an acquired taste, isn't it? Because it does take you out.
Yeah. This book, if it means anything to anyone, took me the longest to finish.
Okay.
The prose is quite jarring.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right, so moving on, and this is a book that was also shortlisted for the Women's Prize for Fiction. No One Is Talking About This by Patricia Lockwood. I have heard many things, some positive, some negative, some mixed. I know stylistically it's quite unique. Tell me what it's about and tell me what you thought of it.
A woman known for her viral social media posts travels the world speaking to her adored fans, her entire existence overwhelmed by the internet of what she terms the portal. Are we in hell? The people of the portal ask themselves, are we all just going to keep this up until we die? Suddenly, two texts from her mother pierce the fray. Something has gone wrong, and how soon can you get here? As real life and its stakes collide with the increasing absurdity of the portal, the woman confronts a world that seems to contain both an abundance of proof that there is goodness, empathy, and justice in the universe, and a deluge of evidence to the contrary. I hated this.
You hated it. Okay. I kind of thought you might have.
It's, how do I describe this book? Okay. So my issue with it is that it feels old for its time, despite it being like now. It feels like a 2010 Tumblr post, which if you've been on Tumblr in 2010, you never want to revisit. And you go, well, that doesn't look good. Like, I don't want anyone seeing that. It's a little bit funny. It's a little bit funny. There's some, like, she gets to the bone on some things. But the first half, I feel, is very, like, knowingly silly. I think it's just Lockwood seeing what she can spurt out in 100 words that's going to shock and offend someone. And then the second part, which is when the texts come, which is about a small child. It's a bit of a handbrake turn.
Not for you.
No, it's too harsh of a handbrake. It's not. It's just thrown in there. And then you kind of have to go, oh, okay, now we have to like not be silly. But equally all the way through this, she's still joking about Charlie bit my finger memes.
So moving on, I loved your video about this one because The Fortune Men by Nadifa Mohammed is set near you in beautiful Wales. Am I right?
Beautiful Wales. Yeah, I lived 5 minutes around the corner from where the crime scene was. So I adventured only 15 minutes up the road. And I kind of did the walk that probably Matan might have done to have murdered this woman. Let's talk about that. Let's get into the blur, baby, before we talk for this. Mahmoud Matan is a fixture in Cardiff's Tiger Bay, 1952, which bustles with Somalia West Indian sailors, Maltese businessmen and Jewish families. He is the father, chancer, sometimes petty thief. He is a smooth talker with an eye for the good game. He is many things, in fact, but he's not a murderer. So when a shopkeeper is brutally murdered and all eyes fall on Mahmood, he isn't too worried. It is true that he has been getting into trouble more often since his Welsh wife Laura left him, but Mahmood is secure in his innocence in a country where he thinks justice is served. And at his home, his three little boys are waiting for him, as is Laura, fierce and full of love, ready to forgive his misbehavior in a heartbeat if he can just straighten up his act.
So we've got a bit of love story, a bit of crime, race, identity, Wales. What did you think?
I really liked this one. I really liked this one. And it's true. It's, apart from one thing, it's all true. Mahmood Matan was the last hangman in the UK, which happened in 1952. He didn't murder the lady in question. We now know who did do it, and he does appear in here. But yeah, you just see a man who thinks he obviously will be innocent because he is innocent, and then realizes how stacked up the cards are against him.
It sounds really powerful.
It is powerful, but I only wish Mohammed stuck with Matar the entire way through. We kind of flit in and out between some characters.
Okay.
Which don't really add anything to the story. It just kind of adds into the confusion of it all. Mm-hmm. But yeah, Matan's bits at the end where he's literally counted down the days, the seconds, and then the final moment as he walks in and sees the noose is like really powerful stuff. Really, really well done. But another thing I like about this book is that Mohammed doesn't sugarcoat anything. Matan is a shifty character and is one of those people, if someone said, oh, he's been down for this, you could see why some people might go, oh, yeah, he's not a great person, actually. Like, that could happen. And then also she's exploring how these people, similar to what we see online, is that people try to form their own connections. Mm-hmm. So even though they know he wasn't there or he couldn't have done it, they're still trying to play the game of, yeah, but I didn't see him do this, or was he wearing a coat? Actually, now I come to think about it. It's great.
So
yeah, really good.
Our penultimate one on the list, Bewilderment by Richard Powers. Were you bewildered by this? Let's find out what it's about.
Surprise, it got published. Theo Bird is a promising young astrobiologist who has found a way to search for life on other planets dozens of light years away. It is also the widowed father of a most unusual 9-year-old. His son Robin is funny, loving, and filled with plans. He thinks and feels deeply, adores animals, and can spend hours painting elaborate pictures. He is also on the verge of being expelled from third grade for smashing his friend's face in with a metal thermos. What can a father do when the only solution offered to his rare, troubled boy is to put him on psychoactive drugs? What can he say when his boy comes to him wanting an explanation for a world that is clearly in love with its own destruction? The only thing for it is to take the boy to other planets, all while fostering his son's desperate campaign to save this one. I loved The Overstory. Overstory is one of the best books I've ever read by Richard Powers, which should have won 2018 Man Booker Prize. Still not over it. This one, as the follow-up, obviously has big boots to fill for me. This feels as though it was cut from The Overstory, that the beginning of this could have slotted in perfectly, and then he's tried to make something else out of it. And I'm very sorry, Richard Powers, but there's too much going on to the point where I don't really know what the point he was trying to say. And some of it feels very lazy in the fact that there is a cameo of a 14-year-old girl who's known for climate change speaking in a very prominent political place. And you go, oh, it's Greta Thunberg. And he's like, but I'm not going to say that. It's someone else.
So we are shocked that this is on the shortlist.
I'm not shocked because the writing's good. Mm. I just don't know what Richard Powers wants me to take from this, because he's entirely pessimistic about the world. It feels as though what he's trying to say is, well, there's no point doing anything because we've gone so far. Why are you preventing the inevitable? Whilst all his other characters are going, but we should care. We don't know how, don't know what to do, but let's do it. But also, let's map a 9-year-old child to the dead mum so he can reconnect with her.
Yeah, this is giving me uncomfortable vibes. So let's move on to the final book of the shortlist, Great Circle by Maggie Shipstead. This is a chunky one.
Yeah, it's the biggest one. It is 600 and about 600 pages, yeah.
That would take me about 3 weeks to read.
This took me a week. It's very well written, very plotty, very interesting. But
okay, so what's the blurb?
From the night she is rescued as a baby out of the flames of a sinking ship to the day she joins a pair of daredevil pilots looping and diving over the rugged forests of her childhood to the thrill of flying Spitfires during the war, the life of Marion Graves has always been marked by a lust for freedom and danger. In 1950, she embarks on her life's dream to fly a great circle around the globe. But after a crash landing, she finds herself stranded on the Antarctic ice without enough fuel. With a fearsome stretch of water separated her from her goal, she writes of what Hadley Baxter, a brilliant, troubled Hollywood starlet, is irresistibly drawn to play Marion Graves, a role that will lead her to probe the deepest mysteries of the vanished pilot's life.
Love a troubled Hollywood star as a trope.
She is troubled. But what's great about this is that you kind of see everyone else revolving around this young child actor and how PR gets in the way and twists and turns and gives a different perspective to different outcomes, which basically is what this novel's doing. So Marion Graves, all her life is based from this logbook of what people have said and hearsay and oral history that's kind of trickled down. So what you have is you're jumping back and forth in time between Marion and Hadley, which marries up really well to begin with. And then something goes wrong. Something's been interpreted the wrong way. And we kind of see how everything that we think about Marion, so who she loves, who her friends were, how all of that spirals out of control to where the role that Hadley thinks she's playing is nothing like the Marion Graves who she believes she is.
Okay,
that's really good.
Yeah, plotty, pacey. You liked it?
I really liked this one, and I would like this one to win.
That was my next question. Really, you'd like...
It was almost as if we arranged this in alphabetical order. But no, I would really like Great Circle to win. I think out of all of them, I think this is great. A lot of food for thought. And I think an interesting way of kind of spooling out truths and lies and how things are both technically true, but could just be viewed from the wrong angle at the wrong time.
Mm-hmm.
This was great.
That was a curveball for me. Right, so I want to hear your top three. So Great Circle by Maggie Shipstead. What are the other two that you would like in the top three if there was a book of top three?
I would probably say The Fortune Men.
Yeah.
And then Light Perpetual.
Light Perpetual. Amazing. Light Perpetual. Okay. How many words do you reckon you've read on this book along list? Millions.
Oh, no. maybe. I wouldn't even know.
Have you enjoyed the experience?
Yes. Yeah. So Booker, for this year, they said they wanted to get people to reconnect with literature. Mm-hmm. So I can't remember who said it, but I'm pretty sure one of the judges said that book club feel.
Mm-hmm.
And these do all feel book clubby to some degree, that they're not super dense. They're not high literature where sometimes you are there going, hang on, like we're talking about some things here that I don't really know.
Mm-hmm.
They're very plotted as a whole. And I think the conversations that people are having with them are good and everyone picks up little different things, even more so compared to the last year's list that I read in its entirety. I think people are having a bit more of a difficult time ascertaining between what will win in this year's, because they're all very similar and all very different in how they approach some things. But all in all, I think if you picked up any of them, I don't think you'd have a bad time.
Who do you think is going to win?
I think Lockwood. And how really pains me to say it, because I really detested the book. But I think Lockwood might actually take it. It's the most experimental out of the lot.
Okay.
It's the most out there. And I think if you were talking about all six books, that one is going to come up a lot. And I think if you talk about a book enough, you could kind of jump the hurdles through. But I could see it winning.
Well, thank you so much for your insight. And thank you so much for joining us on the Brighton Book Club. How can we find and follow you and see your excellent video reviews?
Yes, if you type in KD Books, all one word, my Instagram and YouTube will come up on the lovely Google search engine.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. It's been great.
I am joined by Lois, who is the founder of the Brighton Bookshop. Welcome, Lois, to the Brighton Book Club.
Thank you, Anna. It's nice to be here.
Tell us about the Brighton Bookshop.
So we're an online bookshop. We're based just on Instagram. We're very small and we sell pre-loved secondhand books, with 100% of our proceeds going to different LGBTQ plus causes every month. And we deliver all our books locally in Brighton and Hove by bicycle. And it's run by myself and my partner, Anissa.
When did you decide to start the Brighton Bookshop?
So Brighton Bookshop was a lockdown idea, very much. Born out of boredom, perhaps. I was sitting on the sofa one day and a friend of mine was messaging me about lots of books that she wanted to get rid of. And the idea pretty much fully formed just landed in my brain, to be honest. I'd set up the Instagram account and made a logo within about 20 minutes of having the idea, and spoke to my partner, who she's really into cycling, asked her if she was interested in it as well. She thought it was a great idea. And so that was how it all began, really.
And do you sell solely through Instagram?
We do at the moment, yes. So it's very small scale in terms of how we run things, just because it's like very much a side project on top of full-time things that we do. And it's worked really well, actually, just doing it through Instagram. I think people kind of see the content there. We upload new books every Saturday and they just sort of appear in people's feeds. And it works really well doing it that way. Yeah.
Now, you said that at the end of every month, you give 100% of the proceeds to LGBTQ plus charities. Do you choose a different one every month? And how do you decide where the money goes?
Yeah, that's right. So we, roughly speaking, choose a different cause every month, although we have sometimes let a cause run over for 2 or 3 months if we've had a slightly quieter month, so that we're giving sort of more similar amounts of money to each cause. So a couple of examples of some of the places that we've supported. The first cause that we gave to was Say It Loud Club, who are a fantastic organisation here in the UK that support LGBTQ plus refugees and asylum seekers. So that was our first cause we supported. We've also given money to Books Beyond Bars, who are really great. They send books to people in prison, to queer people in prison. And it was really lovely, actually, because they literally sent us a photo of all the books that they'd been able to buy with the money that we sent them. So that's really wonderful to see. We try to support small grassroots organisations rather than really large charities, so that we can really see where the money is going. So currently, all our funds are going to a fundraiser for trans people and other people that don't have access to state support in Lebanon following the devastating explosion that happened there in Beirut last year.
And are you open to donations, Lois? How can people get their books to you to sell?
Yes, we absolutely are. We wouldn't be able to run without those. That's how we get all of our books and what makes Brighton Bookshop work. So yes, we would love your book donations. We collect most different kinds of books, but mostly books that are in a reasonable condition, although they do not have to be like new at all. And our most popular books are generally modern fiction, especially fiction that's come out in the last sort of year or two, and any LGBTQ books, although we do have quite a wide range of other books. The best thing to do if you're interested in donating is to find us on Instagram at Brighton Bookshop and send us a message with the details of any books you've got. If it's a large amount, we can come and collect them, or we can arrange a drop-off, whatever works best.
And can you recommend 3 books to our listeners? 3 books that you've loved, or 3 books that have been really popular for you guys? Just 3 books that you think people should know about.
Yeah, absolutely. So this was really hard. I've spent ages thinking about this. So here's the three that I came up with in the end. So first of all, as it's spooky season at the moment, Halloween season, as we're recording this, I've chosen a book that's coming out soon at the end of October by local author Alison Rumfitt called Tell Me You're Worthless. I haven't read it yet as it's not out yet, but I'm really, really excited to read it. I think it's going to be brilliant. It's a queer horror story with a fascinating kind of concept about a house that's haunted by fascism. It's a look at what causes right-wing belief, but done in a really creative way. And I think it's going to be really good. So that's my first one. The second is a novel that I just love, which has been out for a long time, but I think is well worth a read, which is Ali Smith's How to Be Both. It's just one of my all-time favourite novels. Ali Smith always sells really well in the bookshop as well. And then finally, another recent release, although this one is actually out, is Sean Fay's The Transgender Issue, which is a really excellent look at trans liberation and how it's inherently tied up with the liberation of all other oppressed groups. I think it's really, really good and well worth a read for everybody.
Lois, thank you so much for those recommendations and thank you very much for coming on. So if people want to get in touch with you and the Brighton Book Club and and the Brighton Book Club, we've got very similar names.
We do.
See that on Instagram and really recommend people to come and do some Christmas gifting with you guys because it's a lovely way to support charities and small local queer businesses.
Yeah, that would be brilliant. Yeah, so it's at Brighton Bookshop on Instagram is the best way to find us, and we add new books every weekend, so if you don't see something that you like, there'll be new books coming soon.
Our book club book this month is The Bass Rock by Evie Wilde. Surging out of the sea, the Bass Rock has for centuries watched over the lives that pass under its shadow on the Scottish mainland. And across the centuries, the fates of three women are linked to this place and to each other. In the early 1700s, Sarah, accused of being a witch, flees for her life. In the aftermath of the Second World War, Ruth navigates a new house, a new husband, and the strange waters of the local community. Six decades later, the house stands empty. Viv, mourning the death of her father, catalogues Ruth's belongings and discovers her place in the past and perhaps a way forward. Each woman's choices are circumscribed in ways big and small by the men in their lives. But in sisterhood, there is hope of survival and new life. Intricately crafted and compulsively readable, The Bass Rock burns bright with anger and love. Now, this was described by The Guardian as a dense, complicated book, which is a gothic novel, a family saga, and a ghost story rolled into one, as well as a sustained shout of anger. I absolutely loved reading this book. It was completely immersive, and I was absolutely blown away by the end and wanted to go straight back to the beginning and start it again. So I'm really, really excited to be joined by the author. Welcome, Evie, to the Brighton Book Club.
Thanks for having me.
Can you introduce yourself?
Sure. I'm Evie Wilde. I am the author of three novels and a graphic novel. I own a bookshop in Peckham, and I grew up between Peckham and Australia. And that's sort of it.
When did you start writing, Evie? Did you always know you wanted to be a writer?
No, I didn't think that being a writer was a thing that people could actually be, I think. I wanted to be a painter, which is equally stupid. and I was quite bad at painting. So that wasn't working out. And I just sort of got the same satisfaction out of writing a short story as I got out of completing a painting, except the final product, although quite bad, wasn't as bad as the painting. And I ended up leaving my job. I did lots of little strange jobs, like I used to work in the Stroke Association Library, which was quite nice, but I could see myself staying there for the rest of my life because I'm quite lazy. And so I booked in to do the creative writing MA at Goldsmiths, just thinking, you know, it would enable me to become more eloquent on the page and hopefully get a better job. And then from there, I had something published online with their online journal and picked up an agent, and then just sort of, it happened fairly smoothly for me, although I'm sure, you know, it didn't feel that smooth. But I know that there are kind of much more interesting, expansive stories about publishing journeys, but mine was quite straightforward.
Can you tell us about the Bass Rock and the story behind it and when you realised you wanted to write it?
Sure. I was, I don't think I ever realised that I want to write something until I am about sort of 3 pages from the end. But I had just had a baby, and the Bass Rock's my third novel, and I'd had a lot of very well-meaning comments when I was working in the bookshop about how, you know, people would see my pregnant belly and then they'd go, well, that's the end of writing for you. And I think they were oddly trying to be nice, but it kind of got me into this sort of state of like worry that it was going to be the end. And, you know, I know that I'm quite good at giving things up, so I was worried about that. So what I would do is every day when my son slept for an hour, I would write. And when you're writing in such short spurts and you've got no time the rest of the time to think about what you're writing about, you just put down what's at the front of your brain and don't worry about it. And actually that was quite freeing and quite nice. And so I just worked for a couple of years like that, really, just little spurts every day. And then by the end of a year and a half, 2 years, I had all of these different timelines and all of these different voices. And they were all about violence and they were all angry. But it wasn't until, it wasn't really until Me Too happened in 2016 that I could see clearly that Sarah in the 1700s, Ruth in the 1950s, and Viv in more or less present day setting were kind of linked. And that was when it started to come together as a novel. And really it was about discarding a lot of the other voices to focus on those three.
Would you be happy to read a page for us?
Sure. I'm just going to read from the beginning. I was 6, and just the two of us, my mother and I, took Bowie for a walk along the beach where she and Dad grew up, the shore a mix of black rock and pale cold sand. It was always cold. Even in summer, we wore wool jumpers and our noses ran and became scorched with wiping on our sleeves. But this was November, and the wind made the dog walk close to us, her ears flat, her eyes squinted. I could see the top layer of sand skittering away so that it looked like a giant bedsheet billowing. We were looking for cowrie shells among the debris of the tide line. I had two digging into my palm, white like the throat of a herring gull. My mother had a keener eye and held 6. I felt the pull of victory slackening. Resting in a rock pool was a black suitcase bulging at the sides. The zip had split, and where the teeth no longer held together, I saw 2 fingers tipped with red nails and 1 grey knuckle where a 3rd finger should have been. The stump of the finger, like the miniature plaster ham I had for my doll's house. The colour had been sucked from the knuckle by seawater, leaving just a cool grey and the white of the bone. It was the bone, I suppose, that made it so much like the tiny ham. I moved my arm to swat something away from my face, and as I did, flies rose from the suitcase in a cloud thick and heavy. Behind me, my mother. "Another one," she called. "I found another one." And then the smell, like a dead cat in the chimney in summer, a smell so tall and so broad that you can't see over or around it. My mother walked up behind me. "What's?" I kept looking at the fingers and trying to understand, my mother pulling me by the arm. Come away," she said, and spitting over and over onto the sand. "Don't look, come away." But the more I looked, the more I saw, and peeking through the gaps between the white fingers was an eye that seemed to look back at me, that seemed to know something about me and to ask a question and give an answer. In the memory, which is a child's memory and unreliable, the eye blinks.
It's such a haunting start to the book and really sets the tone for this kind of, there is the threat of death and being killed the whole way through the book. Was that something that was present from the beginning?
I think it's, you know, being in a female body, it is present from the beginning in a double sense. I think it was important to me that I didn't look away from the things that I think about constantly. And I think my first two books, After the Fire, Still Small Voice and All the Birds Singing, were kind of circling this book in a funny way. The first book is from a male perspective, and it's about Australian masculinity and the trickle-down effects of war and what it does to men. And the second one's about a woman living on her own with past trauma and you know, a monster killing things outside. And so I've really felt like, without deliberately doing it, this is kind of what those two books were leading towards. I knew that I, the other thing is that I love horror, you know, in a bit more of a lighthearted way. I really enjoy reading and watching horror. So I always want to write something that is horrible.
I'd love to know about the research that went into this, Evie. It looks like that you spoke to quite a lot of people in your family and about family history, and you've dedicated this book to the wilds.
The germ for the book before I started writing it would have been my British grandmother, who I knew to be a sort of terrifying, very, very tall, very, very English, chain-smoking ex-addict. And I also knew through my father that she hadn't been great fun as a mum. Mm-hmm. And she's very funny, but very, very dry. And you never really knew as a child where you stood. So she was like difficult as well, very difficult. And looking forward so much to her own death that it was strange. She was looking forward to death because her husband, my grandfather, had died 15 years before, and she was concerned that when she died and went to heaven, because that's where she was pretty sure she was going, that she would meet up with him and he would have already met up with his first wife, who died when she was young and beautiful, and who he perhaps never really got over. So she was all about, like, I've got to get up there and sort this situation out. So I knew her as, you know, not the most vivacious, incredible woman, but someone who was like ready for death. And so this Ruth's part became, in the 1950s, became a reimagining of my grandmother. You know, she obviously wasn't always like that. What happened to her? What sort of life did she live in order for this to be her end point, for her to be sick of everything? That was where it started. And then it diverged a lot from there. As you know, I always set out to write something quite straightforward and based on fact, and then it goes a bit bonkers.
It does. It does in a very good way. And there's this really interesting part towards the end, without giving away too much, where you bring in a completely different voice, situation, scene, characters. What made you decide to do that?
Throughout the book, there are these little vignettes. I think there are 8 of them, with different women throughout time being persecuted in some way, normally in a physical way, by men. And so they were kind of, what I wanted to do was give a feeling of the sheer amount that we're up against. there's a character in the present strand called Maggie, and she has a bit of a monologue where she talks about, if you could see all of the women over the centuries who have been murdered by men all at once in a sort of holographic way, like what that would look like. And that was partly inspired by an Australian map made by a journalist called Sherelle Moody, which is an interactive map with lots of red hearts all over it. And if you click on a heart, it tells you whose body was found there, and it's women and children. And sometimes it will tell you if anyone was prosecuted for it, and the details of the woman or child's life. But the amazing thing about the map is how many times you'll click on a heart and it will just say unknown female. And that felt for me like really confronting, just the idea that this thing, this appalling thing, happens to this woman and she's alone and there's no one there to kind of share a look with or anything, and then nothing is followed up. So it just gave me that that feeling of like a rising tide, I think.
Absolutely. Before we go, Evie, we've had a question on Instagram from Laura, who would like to know if there was a soundtrack either in your head or one that you listened to or one that you would put next to the Bass Rock.
Oh, that's so interesting. I kind of, yes, is the answer, but there are many. For a while, I was listening to the Disintegration Loops, which just makes you go a bit crackers. And when I write, I often write to piano music. So there's a lot of kind of contemporary piano music that I think of. But then also at the same time, pop songs. I love the idea of inappropriate music. You know, in the 1700s, I like to think of like Bruce Springsteen. So yeah, it just, I think all music is about men and women, isn't it? Or relationships. So I think so much of the music of the sort of, you know, from the 30s onwards is quite sinister, even when it's sort of poppy and fun. So yeah, I do find my way into most music thinking about who could be murdered to it.
And what are you working on now, Evie? What's your next project?
At the minute, I am working on my next novel. There's a lot of ghosts in the Bass Rock, and this is kind of me letting myself just purely write about ghosts, which is really good fun.
Amazing. Thank you so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for having me.
Huge thank you to Nigel Stewart for sponsoring this episode of the Brighton Book Club. Nigel is an author from Lancashire whose recent book, The Lines Between Lies, is out now. You can follow him on Twitter at @MeNigelStew. Our next book club book is The View is Exhausting by Michaela Clements and on Julie Data. The book club is also available as a podcast where you can download from wherever you get yours. You can get in touch with us on Instagram at @BTNBookClub and email us at btnbookclub@gmail.com. If you're interested in sponsoring an episode, get in touch and tune in next month for our Christmas book buying special. See you then. Precious.